Thank you. I guess I should So the idea that the coordinates of space and time might not commute is not a new idea. It's been around almost since the days when quantum mechanics was first invented. Now recently, this subject has received renewed interest from string theorists who realized that actually the physics of non-commutative geometry intersects with string theory at many levels. It goes back, I'll mention a little bit. Heisenberg mentioned it in passing, as far as I understand. I'll go through a little bit of history. So it intersects with string theory at many levels, and that's what's gotten people's attention in modern times. However, for the purpose of understanding what non-commutativity is all about for its own sake, there's no need to have any background in string theory. So the purpose of this talk and the goal of this talk is to explain the basic notion of non-commutative geometry in a language which I hope is something that's understandable by someone who has basic backgrounds in quantum mechanics at undergraduate levels. And I will only mention the connection to string theory as I go along, just to point out where the connections are, but I won't go into details for this talk. So what's geometry? What's non-commutative geometry? As far as the geometry part is concerned, one needs to go no further than your online Webster dictionary. The part of the definition that matters for us is the part that says it's a branch of mathematics that deals with things like points, lines, angles, and so on. Well, non-commutative geometry is an attempt to study geometric properties on more general structures that do not necessarily have natural descriptions in terms of points and lines and so on. For example, let's consider generalizing the notion of plane as we know it, having two coordinates x1 and x2, to have the coordinates behave like a non-commutative algebra, like this one. Now, in this case, since these operators are non-commuting, they're not a simultaneous observable, so you cannot simultaneously specify the x1 and x2 coordinates, so the notion of points given by specifying two coordinates in this form is gone. This is why von Neumann in his early days called such a geometry a pointless geometry. So why would we be interested in such a thing? Well, the original motivation and original concrete formulation of such a thing goes back to 1947 by a guy named Harold Schneider. And his motivation was to try to understand the UV divergences that were popping up in field theories that were being studied at the time. So his suggestion was to consider generalizing the algebra of momentum and coordinates to include another non-trivial commutation relation of this form, where a pair of coordinates commute to give an angular momentum. Just as an example, this happens to be actually rather nice because it happens to be a commutation relation that preserves Lorentz invariance. Although this is actually a cute idea, this whole motivation was obviated when the concept of renormalization was invented and when it came to be understood by the physicists of the time. Now, today the motivation is slightly different. So physics as we know it is rather well accounted for using the paradigm of that they are described by localized field theories. All our standard model is based on that paradigm. But there are indications that this locality is only an approximate notion and something that breaks down if you look sufficiently close. And the clearest signal for that comes from the preliminary studies in quantum gravity. Now, gravity comes with a dimensional parameter called the Planck scale, which is this combination of fundamental constants in nature. And in fact, there are many reasons to believe that quantum gravity at distances much shorter than this length scale is very different than the general relativistic intuition consisting of floppy manifolds describing space and time. In fact, thermodynamic estimates from the nature of black hole indicates that the degree of freedom of quantum gravity is in some sense discrete. There are a set finite bits of degree of freedom per unit of area. Well, first of all, the fact that the degree of freedom is discrete to begin with is different from what local field theory tells you, because there are infinitely many degrees of freedom at arbitrary short distance in local field theory. But the signal coming from preliminary study of quantum gravity is even more bizarre than that, in the sense that the degree of freedom is believed to be encoded 1 bit per unit volume rather than area. So clearly this is a strange non-geometric structure, and we'd like to develop intuition for what it means to be doing physics in such a circumstances. And of course this is a situation where things are highly non-local, and non-communal geometry seems like a right language to use to try to develop intuitions and formalisms in such a context. So the goal, I reiterate, is to generalize geometry. Now that by itself sounds like a rather open-ended thing, generalize this, generalize that, you can generalize anywhere. So how can one go about doing this systematically? Well, it turns out that the historical approach that's been taken is a reasonable and sensible one, so I'd like to explain that briefly. The idea is based on the fact that there's a correspondence of a description of manifold as little points and a set of complex value functions on that space. Now, this set of complex valued function forms a ring, a commutative ring, and all that I mean by that is the fact that you can add these two things together and multiply two things together, and the multiplication is commutative because it's a C-valued function. The sense in which these two correspondences can be made precise is realized that for every point x0 in M, I can form a ideal or basically a subset of this original ring that also forms a ring, which happens to have a property that this function vanishes at the point x. Clearly, if you multiply two such things or add two things together, you still have function in that set. And if I add any function that doesn't satisfy that property, I can recover the whole function. It's easy to see this, but I'll explain this only if I'm pressed. In fact, it's a basic fact proven in the theorem by Gelfand in 1984 that the algebraic structure of this ring encodes essentially all of the topological structure that you care about of the manifold M. And in a more recent development, it was pointed out by Cohn that if you supplement this algebraic structure with a differential operator acting on this A, something that takes element of A to itself, that encodes metric data. Just to illustrate this point, suppose I'm interested in a distance between two points x and y. Oh, I'm sorry. I should. Right now, I'm talking about ordinary commutative geometry before I talk about non-commutative geometry. I should have mentioned that I'm leading up to it by thinking of a different way to think of commutative geometry, and then I'll make the departure to non-commutative geometry later. The distance between points x and y is a well-defined notion in commutative geometry, and how do you encode that in the algebraic language? Well, we have the algebra functions, and we are allowed to add, multiply, do various things, and we are allowed to act on by differential operators. So one can, for example, define it as a maximum of difference of functions evaluated at two points for a set of functions whose basically gradient is less than one, and that, yes, and yeah. I always find it useful just to think about the flat space to get clearly, if I have a flat space, I have two directions and I have differential. Just derivative. Yeah, okay, norm two. I am not going to go about setting this thing at the axiomatic level where everything is accounted for, but I think when people talk about C sister algebras, the norms are implicit. I won't go at that level of detail, but yeah. Well, as long as you have a norm, as you say, norm is necessary. It's a norm on a set of function space, not in the XY space. And this is a trick for converting the norm in a function space to distances in the XY space. And the instructor that we needed was basically, I mean, in some sense, it's. Yeah, the partial derivative acts on multidimensional. So this is the norm is taken. So it's d mu is being squared. Yeah. What comes with the differential structure? Yeah, I mean, in some sense, in order to define this, you need the metric. But what I'm saying is that suppose I just give you this without giving you the metric, how d acts on A, you can reconstruct the metric. That's what's being said about. If I just tell you what a derivative of a function is, without telling what a derivative operator is, and you give me a function, I'll give you back a derivative. That if you can with that information alone, you can reconstruct the metric. That's all that's being said here. Yes, please. Yeah, of all functions with. No, for the whole ideal. Yeah. This is not terribly, I mean, it's meant to be schematic anyway. I don't want to dwell on this formula. Sure. Now, I want to assure everyone that this reformulation of manifolds in terms of algebra is actually very sensible and something we do all the time. After all, function and space, we define functions and space all the time when we talk about field theories because things like scalar fields are nothing but functions on the space. So the paradigm of extracting the property of the manifold from the property of the algebra is essentially no different than extracting the properties of the manifold from the from the property of the field theories defined on them. Just to be more concrete about what I mean by that, let me give you two examples of how one algebraically defines a geometric concept and how one can think of that in physicist language. So for example, let's say talk about the dimension of the space, which is a geometric notion. In the algebraic reformulation, based on this A and derivative operator and so on, this can be characterized by looking at how the eigenvalue of the Laplace operator grows. Generally, you can show for ordinary d-dimensional space that if we use the traditional language of Dirac operators and differential operators on flat space, then we'll notice that the eigenvalues grow like number of eigenvalues of the operator who's less than lambda, say, grows like lambda to the d, and that d can be used to read off the dimension of the space. Another example was the volume. And that volume is simply the coefficient of the leading asymptotic behavior. I learned recently that this was a problem that Lorentz assigned in 1910 as a challenge for mathematicians to prove in the Caltech conference. Isidore Singer mentioned this as an example of how physicists and mathematicians interact over the past millennium. And apparently this was solved by Hermann Weyl eventually. So this was just an algebraic reformulation of traditional geometric notion that we all know about. And of course, the philosophy here is to take this is a theorem, but you can take it back within it as a definition in the cases where the original, usual notion of geometry don't exist in the first place. But just to show that these definitions are sensible, one can see that this algebraic reformulation is very familiar from the physicist. After what this amounts to is to consider free field theory on this space and extracting the volume and the dimension from the way the entropy is generally expected to behave in such a space. So it's essentially that, taking the property of physical theory and extracting geometric structure based on how we believe things ought to behave. And the whole point of doing this reformulation is that this is a convenient place to take as a point of departure from going from ordinary geometry to non-commutative geometry. So as I mentioned earlier, this algebra A of functions were a commutative ring. And to go to non-commutative geometry, the proposal is to simply consider a more general class of ring, just make them non-commuting, and ask, well, what could it associate to some underlying geometry? Well, now these fields or element of the algebra, excuse me, are operator valued, so it should be thought of as something acting on a Hilbert space. Operators generally act on Hilbert space, and it's not well defined until you specify that, so let's specify that too. And finally, I mentioned that in the commuting case, I needed a differential operator to encode the structure of things like distances between points. Basically, the metric structure of the space was encoded by having a differential operator. So at abstract level, what one means by non-commutative geometry is to specify these data. The algebra, the differential operator, and the Hilbert space specify what one means by non-commutative geometry. And of course, the geometric interpretation is whatever the geometric thing happens to correspond to. Now, all of this is rather abstract, so I want to go to I want to spend more time talking about examples and general principles. So let me give you a couple of examples. The first one, I'll discuss something already mentioned in the introduction, is the Heisenberg plane, which is something that, say, a two-dimensional plane whose coordinates x1 and x2 satisfy a non-trivial commutation relationship, where right-hand side is a C number, and from dimensional analysis, you see that delta has to have dimension of length. So we would like to construct the full structure of the Hilbert space, the ring, and the differential operator on which this algebra acts faithfully. And of course, this is very familiar from quantum mechanics. In fact, the structure is pretty much reminiscent of the structure of the phase space in ordinary quantum mechanics. So we can construct the Hilbert space, for example, in harmonic oscillator basis by making a creation and annihilation operators out of the x1 and x2 in the form reminiscent of the operator structure of the creation and annihilation in phase space. So this set of all states created by acting on a vacuum with a raising operator would be a suitable space on which this algebra would act. So what one means by function on that space? Well, I can think of a function in Taylor expansion in coordinates like this. Of course, since x1 and x2 are non-commuting, I have to specify the sense in which I choose to order my factors when I define the coefficients. So I'm trying to represent the element of this ring by these coefficients, but these coefficients are only well defined once I specify the ordering of these guys. So let's say I use the rule that I always symmetrize x1 and x2 whenever I see them. That way, I can represent the element of this algebra by this chain of data. Of course, then multiplying those two things combined with this algebra is well defined because I can just take two of them, multiply together, reshuffle them in the form that it takes to put it into this back form back, and read off the coefficients. So the algebra of functions are well defined, and these are set of, essentially, since x1 and x2 are the operators used to define the Hilbert space, these are the space of general space of all operators acting on this Hilbert space. And finally, I would like to have a differential operator, and I'll cook one up that's relatively well motivated. Suppose, so let me just say I commute the operator with x over the Christie-Lewis-Schmidt tensor. Now this is a sensible choice because it does what you expect it to do on functions of the form that are familiar to us. For example, if I have x1 raised n times, well, okay, it's familiar from the form of Hamilton-Jacobi equation. This structure is all that it amounts to. But you can see that, for example, the nth power of x1 acting on by commuting with x2, which is what d1 is, will give me back n times the one less, which is exactly how differential operator generally works. On the other hand, if I differentiate x2, that's like commuting with x2, and they commute, so it's zero. So this is a sensible differential operator. I'm sorry. Yeah, so I have to divide this by delta here and there, and I think the point about that is sufficiently clear. Actually, let me just pause. How many people here are mathematicians, just out of curiosity? Yeah. So I'm really not talking at the level of mathematics. You know, just apology from the beginning. I'm talking about this from the physicist perspective. In fact, if anyone has questions about axiomatic details, they're there. Okay. So all that ingredient is enough to start constructing interesting non-trivial field theories. For example, I can write down a non-commutative version of the scalar phi-4 theory with the ingredients we have, where these terms are written based on inspiration of how they how they resemble the corresponding commutative theory. So I told you that commuting with x is like differentiating. So this is inspired by the obvious kinetic term, the mass term, and the interaction term. Now I mentioned that these fields are operators, and operators are essentially are matrices acting which are indexed by the vectors of the Hilbert space. So these are just matrices that I multiply next to each other, and I've traced them. Now because this is a matrix, the Feynman rules that you would develop out of this will have the standard ribbon form that we see all the time in matrix field theory. Now in this way, I think it's clear the following point is clear. In commutative theory, what one means by field is something that takes coordinates x and y as an input and generates a number. Well, non-commutative fields are clearly different than that, because it doesn't take x and y coordinates as an input, because x and y don't exist as a notion in the first place. What it does instead is to take elements in the product of Hilbert space and give a number back. Essentially, that's how one extracts a number from an operator. You compute its expectation value based on some states. So what happened here is that the notion of space got replaced by a tensor product of two Hilbert spaces. So that's the sense in which the story changed between commutative and non-commutative theory. Now, of course, we might be interested in how a Heisenberg plane approximates commutative physics in some sense, at large distances perhaps. And the best way to do that is to choose to put in place of these operators, these states, a coherent state, which is something that's the best approximation to a localized state from the point of view of wave functions. I can create a state that's localized around a given point x1, x2, x and y with uncertainty of the scale of the non-commutativity. Now, it's also clear that if I were to take an operator like this and sandwich it with the coherent state and take the limit that delta goes to zero, in some sense, the coherent state will get narrower and narrower and narrower, and I'll reproduce the notion of evaluating this function at a point, but that, you know, approximation being smeared by the typical size of the coherent state. Did you have a question, Steve?
There's also the notion of defining the first state like the
Yeah. So roughly speaking, if you go, I'll come back to that in a couple of seconds. It's easier for me to talk about it after I have a star product. So. Well, so M and N could be any, M and N are anything. Yeah, M and N are any element of the Hilbert space. Yes. This is, well, all I've done is give you two vectors. As long as I give you two vectors, then I can always pencil them, and that's what this is, right? So I can choose to use a coherent state if I want to. And from this product, that's equally something that acts as an input in evaluating this function. So I just picked it out of a hat, but it's a picking that allows from I have a hat to begin with, it's a Hilbert space, and I can take any element of the Hilbert space. I happen to pick this one, which happens to have, so the issue is like over completeness and counting, those kind of things. I'm not making any statement that I'm making a change of basis. All I'm saying is I picked an element. And this is a convenient element from the point of view of approximately localizing something. Right? Now, of course, I picked two to be the same here, with the eye on sandwiching it in, say, something like this to probe the the property of the essentially what amounts to probing the property at that point. But generally speaking, these two didn't have to be related at all. I could have chosen yes. No, I'm sorry. These M and N are just also a label of the element of the Hilbert space, and it's so I had X1 and X2 that had a creation operator, and I had a lattice in some sense for the harmonic oscillator basis. But at this point, there's no clear sense in which the space time has become a lattice. All I'm saying is that the basis. M and N, yeah. But there's no sense in which I'm proposing that M and N combination has in any way obvious interpretation of something localized here or there. It's some blob. And a particular combination that has the interpretation as points the best it can is the coherent state, is what I am saying. Maybe I'm not being clear, but all I'm saying is that a generic class of XYs, in quantum mechanics, there's a notion. Well, so in quantum mechanics, there's a P and X, and there's a state that you can create, which is Gaussian supported localized somewhere in XP plane. That's and I can make that so the vacuum is the same thing at the origin of this, and if I translate this in phase space vacuum with something like e to the I P times, P operator times P naught plus X operator X naught, roughly, that'll move it to X naught P naught, and that's this thing that I've created, and it's as close. And by Heisenberg assumption principle, I can't localize it any more than that. So that's why I'm saying it's the approximate notion of a space. So I have one and two. Upstairs and downstairs doesn't mean anything. All right. Yes, I apologize. This is a Taylor series expansion, and that MN is different. Now, the only point I wanted to make is that because it's something that takes two elements of Hilbert space as an input, and I could have chosen coherent states at different points, one can think of this as in some sense, a degree of freedom that senses two points at the same time, when some sense what one might call bilocal. And this is perhaps the first place where the hint that it might be like a string comes in. And in fact, I guess there are several papers who tries to push this picture. Say a string with n points at two points x1 and x prime, y prime interact in such a way that these two points are roughly interacting independently. Of course, they're connected by a string, so they're not completely independent, but locally, they look like the endpoints are interacting independently, and in some sense, the structure that non-commutativity forced on us for ordinary field theory seems to have similar properties. The sense in which non-commutativity and string theory is related is actually quite well, this is probably a good point to point out that in some sense, string theory is also a very complicated non-commutative geometry because of the following fact. The sense in which the strings interact that's the way in which, two strings join and become a third one also defines a non-commutative associative product. They're non-commutative because the way the strings interact, the cyclic ordering of these external states are fixed by the topology of the diagram. So I can't take two and take it all the way to one without doing something topologically, but sort of changing the topology of the diagram. It is associative because in some sense it doesn't matter whether I think of this as 1 and 2 joining first and becoming a 3 or 1 and 3 joining first and becoming a 2. This is how strings interact, but these string excitations are in some sense nothing but fields living on space-time, which you can sort of sum up in a fancy word called string fields, but these are just roughly speaking fields on space-time, and I've just defined an algebra of how to combine two things and give you another one that are non-commuting associative. So in some sense, the dynamics of strings is also defining non-commutative geometry underlying the space-time of string theory, whose non-commutativity scale is set by the scale of tension alpha prime. It's complicated algebra. I'm not claiming I understand what the underlying geometry ought to be interpreted as or to be felt as, but nonetheless, it's just an algebra like any of the others that I've discussed so far. Of course, in the case of a string theory, I can take alpha prime to zero to reduce all the strings to all but the particle content in the lightest state. And in this way, string theory, has the non-commutative scale, but can be taken to zero. And I'll be saying a little bit more about this limit later. But anyway, so this is a first instance where string theory appears in analogy to string theory. This is taking much longer than I thought, so I'm going to skip a few things. So far, what I'm saying is that non-commutative geometry is basically give me an algebra, give me a spectral triple, these three data, and I'll try to think of it as a sub-geometry, and I've just constructed an example of something I know how I'm supposed to interpret it as because I constructed it explicitly by hand. I said I want to have a plane that has coordinates that doesn't commute. So I knew what that was to begin with. I constructed algebra, generally speaking, given any algebra, I should be able to interpret. Whatever the geometric interpretation of that is. I'll say about that a lot. Yeah. But the point I want to make is that all that is fine and dandy, but it's rather formal and cumbersome to deal with. So I'm going to introduce a notational shorthand. And the notational shorthand is that, which I call the subproduct. And it's just a different way of writing how one multiplies two things, which is defined in this way. Now, this has a nice property that, first of all, you can show that it's an associative product, which you will check by hand. And it also happens to satisfy this following commutation relationship, which is highly suggestive of it's essentially the same algebraic form as the non-commutativity of the Heisenberg plane that I was talking about. If you take this to be two-dimensional and set the delta square that I'm talking about to be the theta 1, 2. So what this means is that the algebra of ordinary functions using a style product is isomorphic to the algebra of operator value functions I was talking about before. So in some sense, I can forget entirely about all that algebra and the traces and the x's and work strictly in the language of style products by choosing to multiply things using it. Yeah, so this is a product defined on ordinary set of functions. And so these are ordinary functions that I just happen to choose to define to multiply this way. So using that, I can write the same action that I wrote in a previous transparency using traces and complicated commutators in this more suggestive form. Now, one can check that that the content of this and the other one that I wrote before is the same diagram by diagram in perturbation theory. Now, I guess one thing I should say is that to check diagram by diagram in perturbation theory, it's convenient to work in momentum space. If I take two things that are more or less the same and star product, start multiplied by each other, the fact that it's stop product doesn't really matter, pretty much primarily owing to the fact that it's this data, I should have mentioned, is an anti-symmetric matrix. Well, it has to be, since it came from a commutation relationship. So the propagator of this will more or less be the same as ordinary field theory, but in a four-point interaction, just from the way these star products combine, you'll find that there are phases having to do with this external momentum that comes in for an interaction like this one. Now, I'm only claiming that the content of this theory is identical to this one, which is a little bit of algebra to verify it, but I should mention what one means by doing Feynman diagram in momentum space in this picture, since, well, usually we think of momentum space as a Fourier transform of coordinates, but since coordinates are no longer there, what do you mean by that? Well, it just so happened that this basis of tensor product in Hilbert space can be spanned by operators of this form, which looks like a plane wave where X is an operator, and I can basically create any state like this as a superposition of the plane waves, and I can create any plane waves as a superposition of this. So this is, in some sense, how one changes the notion of Fourier transform. The notion of Fourier transform changed, but the momentum space of this and this is going to look more or less the same, so the physics is the same. So at this point, at least when we're dealing with Heisenberg planes, we're at liberty to think of non-commutative geometry as simply studying field theories of physics of field theories where we agree to multiply them using the star product all over the place. Of course, underlying that is all the Hilbert space and observables and so on, but one can forget about that until the last stage where you choose to interpret the results of your calculation. The content is the same. So this inspires us to write many other field theories that we may care to study. For example, it's very easy to write down what non-commutative analog of a gauge theory might be. So gauge theory should come with a gauge transformation, with the property that it's invariant under arbitrary gauge transformation, and that requires us to have a generally a spin one particle. And, well, essentially just an exercise of deciding how lambda should transform the gauge potential and how the gauge potential, how the dynamics, what kind of dynamics one should assign to the gauge potentials in such a way that the full dynamics is gauge invariant. Well, it's actually rather easy once one familiarize oneself with non-abelian gauge theories because the structure is essentially the same. The point is that the lambdas and a's are to be multiplied by star products, so they don't commute. Multiplying to the left or right will give you something else. So this suggests then that if I transform the gauge potential in the following form, completely suggestive of the way we transform non-abelian gauge theories, then if we define a covariant field strength also in the same form, this guy will be gauge covariant in analogy with the non-abelian gauge theories, and the action defined in this way will be gauge invariant. I could sprinkle this with the UN. This is for U1. So I actually had some comments about instantons in this. Well, so some comments about non-commutative gauge theories. Well, it's a square in a star product, so in some sense it has the usual BPS type bound, and so there are instanton solutions. And the property of instanton solutions is one of the cute things that has been understood about non-commutative gauge theory. But in absence of time, I'm going to skip most of the details. So the goal now, so now that I've sort of reduced the game of playing of studying non-commutative geometry to just writing a field theories with star products and understanding its physical properties, what we would like to do is to understand the physical content of these theories? Well, at least at the modest level, we would like to understand the scales that are involved in such a dynamics. Now, at the classical level, the scales involved are rather clear. There are new scale having to do with non-commutativity, which is implicit in the star product. The star product had these exponentials of derivatives with these coefficients. So there are infinitely many high derivative interaction terms that are generated by expanding that star product. So this non-commutativity scale enters as the important new scale that's involved with the physics of such a theory. In fact, because it's a high derivative interaction, it's sensitive to higher frequency modes and not low. So in some sense, at the classical level, it's clear that the physics that changes is in the high frequency or the UV modes and not the infrared. The structure of such a theory having infinitely many higher order derivative interactions is actually quite reminiscent of string theory, which is another place where the connection to string theory pops up. So in non-commutative geometry, we see a series of higher order derivative terms controlled by the non-commutativity scales, whereas the string theory has a arbitrary high order derivative interaction controlled by the alpha prime, the string tension scale. So So renormalization of this theory is one of the understood problems of. I'm talking classically right now. At the naive perturbative analysis seems to say that the non-commutativity scale does not need to be renormalized. There are still questions. If I had time, I might say a little bit more about this, right now we're discussing classical physics of this, let's get to quantum later. So I was just mentioning that here's another point where similarity string theory pops up, and in fact, string theory and non-commutative geometry are indeed intimately related. So I mentioned earlier that string theory is defining a rather complicated non-commutative geometry on its own, but it tends to reduce to a ordinary point particle dynamics limit. I take this string theory's version of non-commutativity parameter to zero. But what one can do is to take a slightly different way of taking alpha prime to zero limit and recover the full, a slightly different limit, which happens to match the non-commutative dynamics based on star products that I've been talking about so far. So the idea is the following. Which is due to Kohn-Douglas and Schwarz. If you have a D-brain in string theory and an open string attached to it, then the usual upper prime goes to zero limit leads to a ordinary supersymmetric Young-Neel theory living on the world volume of the brain. Now what one can choose to do, so this is a string theory with a D-brain, and a string theory comes with various fields. One of them is a thing called the Nebus-Schwarz two-form field. And suppose I turn a background of that on and scale the strength of this in a particular way as I take alpha prime to zero. So let me propose to do this. What that will do is to give rise to dynamics on the world volume of the brain, which is precisely the non-commutative version of the n equal 4 supersymmetric Young-Neels, basically taking the ordinary Young-Neels and putting star products all over the place. So indeed, it was no accident that these two diagrams, this diagram and the structure of the star product were resembling each other. I can take the structure of the non-commutativity here and take a particular limit to extract just the structure of the star product that I've been talking about. So the Heisenberg plane, in some sense, is implicit as a limit of this picture. And in fact, this is really nice. Because in this kind of language of taking string theory and taking a special limit, string theorists have come up with various exotic theories that has focused our attention in the past couple of years. One of them with the ordinary gauge theory as a limit of fringe theory, and of course, the ADS-CFT conjecture of Malacena is an example of how, by taking a string theory and looking at a corner, which becomes the gauge theory, one recovers more information about the theory than one had before, so it was instructive. In a similar spirit, there is this rather new exotic theory known as the little string theory that has been occupying string theory's attention in the past couple of years. I don't think I have time to go over the details of what this theory is, but it's something that pops up in a very similar spirit. So there are D brains in string theory, and there are also other brains. One of them is so-called the Neighbor-Short spy brain. And on this, one discovers a rather exotic six-dimensional interacting dynamics, which is not very well understood, and in fact, many people are actively spending time trying to understand this theory better. Now, what's cute is that the non-commutative gate theory that we've been discussing so far fits right in between these two theories in the order of sophistication, which I choose to evaluate based on, the more strange feature it has, I've put it at higher in this table. So what do I mean here? So all of these theories are non-local, and that's why it gets next year. But little string theory is slightly more weird than non-commutative gauge theory because, I didn't really have time to explain the thermodynamics of this theory either, but little string theory exhibits this rather strange Hagenon transition thermodynamic behavior, which is also shared by the string theory in flat space. Now, of course, all of these theories are much simpler than the full string theory. Among other things, this is the one theory that contains gravity, whereas all of these other theories do not. So in as much as it doesn't contain gravity, we believe that these theories are much simpler and interesting. And of course, what this is saying is that if we want to understand little string theory better, well, it will be very useful to understand nonlinear geometry first, because in some sense, it's a simpler version of some of the complication that we will encounter when we study. And of course, then is to be said about the whole string theory as well. Of course, one can sort of take the top-bottom approach or bottom-up approach, but the goal ultimately is to understand all of this, and all of this is interesting to us. Of course, ordinary gauge theory is very interesting to us also, and we hope that these connections are useful in exploiting the way all of those things are. Well, in some sense, that's how I came up with this table. All of these things are things that we get from string theory, and therefore they're in the table to begin with, right? So they're getting an endorsement or seal of approval from string theory in the sense that it exists as a corner of string theory, and if you're interested in string theory, all of these are interesting too, right? For two reasons. Just to understand the corner, and also to use this to bootstrap your way up in understanding the top. Now, I really wanted to talk about quantum properties, but I think I want to talk about something else more. So there's some pictures that you might want to see, and if you have questions later, please talk to me. I wanted to talk a little bit about ADS-CFT, which popped up, and it's something that I've been working with Sanyu Itzaki here in Santa Barbara. The reason I want to talk about this more is because it kind of ties in with the story of how this has something to do with little string theory and so on, that I think is more interesting than sort of diagrammatic perturbation theory, which is, in some sense, okay, it's still weird, and I'm not saying that we understand that part of the story, but the actual mechanics of it is more tedious, so I decided not to skip that amount of time. So the point is, we want to understand quantum dynamics of these theories, and there are several tools available to us. Usually, you would have thought perturbation theory is all that we had, but in light of the recent work of Malacena, we acquired a new tool, and the new tool is to use the ADS-CFT, which is inherently probing. So generally, one says that a gauge theory is dual to a string theory from background, but this string theory background is easily understood in the limit where the coupling of the gauge theory is strong or it's highly quantum. So any information contained in the ADS-CFT dual is intrinsically a quantum information. So this is a new tool for us, which is what all that excitement about Malacena conjectures were all about. Well, let me briefly go over what ADS-CFT is in the traditional sense, in the traditional story. It's canonical examples, the relation between N equal 4 super young milk theory and string theory on ADS-5 cos S5, as I mentioned briefly, and it's some space-time with some metric. Of course, the string theory is a very difficult thing to study in this background, but the supergravity approximation of that is relatively under control. This space has a property that it has a time-like boundary whose topology is R4, and that's the R4 in some sense that you can think of the field theory has to be living in. A canonical observable that one computes is things such as the correlation function of gauge invariant operators, say, trace of F squared, and the way to calculate that, which was developed by these people, is simply think of, so for given operator of this sort, there corresponds a space-time field in the string theory description of ADS-5 cos S5. Let's say the F squared corresponds to dilaton, which happens to be true. One can calculate this kind of correlation function by asking how a source for dilaton I put at the boundary of ADS gets felt at this other point. Again, I don't want to go through the mechanics of that, but based on those sets of words, these authors were able to show a fairly sensible behavior of the correlation function of such an observable. And another basic feature that I think I'd like to mention about the ADS-CFT correspondence is that in some sense, the scale of the energy scale of the field theory, the boundary, is encoded in this ADS dual in the following energy to radius relationship. What I mean here is that the larger energy phenomena tends to take place at larger value of radius. For example, when we compute something like a correlation function, the signal at Y will penetrate at infinity will penetrate the interior for a while and come back and make its presence known at some separated point. And the extent to which it penetrates the interior has to do with the scale being probed by the separation. Anyway, this is all basic features of ADS-CFT that has been occupying our attention in the past couple of years as well. And one can ask, well, what's the supergravity dual of the non-commutative Young Mills that we'll be talking about? And this dual was something that I found together with Sani and independently discovered by Malafena and Russo. And of course, well, it's a background, so I'll have to write a metric like this, which is not very illuminating if I just show it to you. But I decided to draw a picture for you where, so what do I have here? What I have here is a 3 plus 1 dimensional gauge theory whose, say, the 2-3 plane has been replaced from ordinary plane to a Heisenberg plane. So what that does is it changes the 2-3 component of the metric of the space-time dual. So what I've done, and of course, if I take delta to 0, this gives back the ADS metric. In fact, let's forget about all these fields and just look at the form of the geometry. The fact that I have this non-commutativity changes the geometry slightly, and perhaps the easiest way to visualize that is just to draw this function. So what I've done for you here is this red dotted line is what that component of the metric looks like in the ADS-5 cos S5 geometry, and by turning a non-commutativity, it changed as a function of U at large U. Now, I mentioned briefly before that the difference in U,
and in some sense, this is the closest I'll get to the normalization flow that you're asking about. This is not precise, but
difference in a very different value of U corresponds to diverse energy scale. So this picture is consistent with the intuition at quantum level that physics and infrared didn't change so much, but the non-commutativity changed the structure of the ultraviolet drastically. I will try to finish soon. I might go 3 minutes, but not much more than that. Now, okay, so that's the ADS dual. And the spirit of the statement is no different than the Malafena's original conjecture. Now, I mentioned that the things like these correlation functions are characteristic observable that one would choose to compute in this framework. However, it turns out that if you try to do that here, the result will go awry. And the problem is that, well, of course, in the spirit of similar to what I was talking about before, all one likes to do is to place a source here and how that is felt at some distance away at the boundary of that space at infinity. But what seems to be the problem is that the nature of the geometry at U, large U, changed drastically, as I plotted here. And that change was bad enough to make the calculation that worked very well for the ADS not work in this case. Now, in one sense, it's disappointing. But in some sense, it's good that it didn't make sense, because it turns out that in non-kinetic theory, something like trace F squared is not a Gaussian invariant observable. In analogy to non-Abelian gauge theory, trace of F squared is not an invariant object, but a covariant object which remembers the fact that the lambda is multiplying to the left and right. And tracing over gauge index really doesn't affect the fact that the star products are non-commuting. So this guy is a non-gauge invariant object. I can make this invariant by integrating over all space. However, that is not useful, at least from the point of view of calculating the position dependence of the correlation function, because by integrating the observable all over the place, I lose the information that I want to keep about where the sources are. So the problem of calculating the GKPW, these authors' style correlation function, the attempt to compute the correlation function in that manner, broke down. But it broke down because the observable that we're trying to compute were not gauge invariant. Now, it so happens that this rather weird large U behavior that we see in non-commutative gauge theory is actually rather similar in nature to what one finds if we try to do similar calculation, say, to the ADS dual of the little string theory, or to the flat dimensional 10 dimensional string theory, which has also been so now I'm taking this as the ADS analog, being the flat space, and asking what the boundary theory might be. But attempts to calculate something like this were sick or didn't behave well in these cases either, and we're finding that it's not behaving here for a similar reason. So in some sense, what one can learn from this is that the problems that one encountered in computing correlation function in little string theory and flat 10-dimensional context can also be understood in terms of issues having to do with gauge invariance. Of course, notion of gauge invariance is a little bit exotic in here and here, but this negative results point to that story. So actually, I am going to stop now. So I hope toward the end, I apologize for rushing a little bit, but the first half of the talk was sort of motivating the basic structure of non-commutative geometry, and I hope that part at least I hope I made it clear enough a case that non-commutative geometry is not such a complicated idea at all. Just take the obvious familiar notion of phase space in quantum mechanics and try to interpret that as space-time and take it to its logical conclusions, and the structures that I talk about will pop up naturally. At the formal level, one can just condense all of non-commutative geometry in specifying the spectral triple. So if you'll give me a spectral triple, I'll write down a field theory that interacts in some way that I choose for you. So in some sense, all that you ever need to know about non-commutative geometry is encoded in the spectral triple. But if you're a pragmatic citizen and don't want to deal with all this formal fancy stuff, we can just think of it, at least for a particular example of a Heisenberg plane, as just doing field theory by using star product to multiply things. Now, I hope I also managed to convey to you the idea that this is actually a rather interesting and tantalizing subject, especially because it bears many resemblances to string theory and little string theory at many levels. And in this way, it might be a useful conceptual tool to understand these more exotic tools better. But having said that, I must confess that we don't really understand the detailed dynamics of these field theory in non-commutative geometry, just the star product theories, exactly what's going on with the dynamics at the quantum level. I didn't have time to talk about perturbation theory and so on, but there's some strange things that show up there that we have yet to understand. And we understood that we couldn't calculate the correlation function of something like curiosity f squared, but what do you compute instead? We don't really have a good answer. Eventually, making a plot like this, where it's some observable light probing with respect to distance that behaves the same as commuting theory at large distances but changes and smoothing out at short distance, is what one would like to plot and convince ourselves that we understand the dynamics at all levels of details. But things like that we don't have yet, so that's the goal. Anyway, thank you. So I know of one context where they try to use this as a sort of a formal way of establishing that the quantum plateaus are quantized. But it's so it turns out that if you think of this as a momentum space, is the one that's satisfying the Heisenberg not position space. But if you change your perspective and there's some topological invariants that you can define on momentum space that are natural, something like a homology cycle of the momentum space. And the formula for that turns out to look like a transverse current in a quantum Hall effect. So in that way, this homology of momentum space gets interpreted as the quantum Hall plateau. But it's a formal statement. I don't know of any other. So you're saying that the non-commuting space-time U1 field theory gets interpreted into space. I see. So that's different than what I'm talking about. But who did that? And huh? I see. Okay. Well, pleasure to make your acquaintance. Yes. So that's one thing I skipped. Yeah, so I skipped that because I decided that this is something that I didn't want to spend too much time on today. But basically, I think the fuzzy geometry is the next simplest example. And but it's actually rather different because, for example, the entropy, the dimension of this space is actually 0, not 2. Now that you ask this, I can spend some time pointing. Sphere with monopole and center plus, sphere with monopole and center and the lowest lambda level is exactly this. The plane is not lowest lambda level. I told you that the dimension is defined by how the eigenvalues of the Laplace operator grows as I take the eigenvalue to be large, and so it was essential that the non-commutative plane supported arbitrary higher momentum states for it to be interpretable as two-dimensional object. And the fact that the Hilbert space is infinite dimensional for the Heisenberg plane and the corresponding operator algebra is infinite dimensional was what essentially allowed me to support that. What this thing does is to make a finite dimensional Hilbert space corresponding to spin Hilbert space. So the Hilbert space is finite, the operator algebra is also finite n by n matrices. So it has to stop somewhere. And if it has to stop somewhere, it can go with asymptotic form. So by the definition of dimension that I alluded to earlier, the dimension is zero. That's what this picture is supposed to be indicating. But let's see. Generally speaking, I think the concrete algebra, which has a geometric interpretation already given to you because you started with something that's already geometric, I think the list is actually relatively small. That's the so.
You could say any algebra, any triple, but then you wouldn't.
That's right. That's right. If I just give you an arbitrary algebra, you don't know how to take the limit. They very, very well probably don't. So, like I say, the examples are limited in number, and But you know, they're all isolated examples like that. There's nothing broad that I think Nick is asking for. Could you say louder? Yeah. So it appears that it doesn't, but not very well understood. So the point was, what happens if you start doing quantum field theories, and what kind of divergences you encounter, and generically. So I just picked this. Phi to the fourth theory and attempt to calculate the one particle reducible two-point function. And what is generally the case is that the planar diagrams in this ribbon notation doesn't care about non-commutativity, so it's going to diverge the same way, in the sense that all the phase factors cancel out. But that is to be renormalized in the usual way. Now, the ones that are non-planar tends to be finite. So that doesn't need to be normalized. As far as we're concerned. So we either renormalize the thing that we normalize in the usual way, or other things which don't need to be normalized. So it doesn't appear to be necessary to renormalize data. But this is not something that we understand very, very well. Experimentally, in trial and error sense, you try to compute and you find that you didn't need to. But the physics of this renormalize one particle reducible two-point function is, like I say, it's rather strange, and it's not something that I think we understand completely. I can explain this more, but I think it's probably better to save this for private discussion.